We use AI in sorting all of that data to look for that genetic expression in each individual cell. That's how we determine whether or not you have endometriosis.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is how to use AI in diagnosing endometriosis. Endometriosis affects 10 to 20% of women between the ages of 15 and 44 and contributes to a large fraction of female infertility. Around 35 to 50% of endometriosis patients experience infertility issues. Mostly it's around the reproductive organs in the pelvis or the abdomen, but more rarely it can also grow around other internal organs. And if endometrial tissue is growing outside the uterus, it still has the same hormones that act on it every month to shed, but it can't actually shed. So there's a buildup of tissue outside the uterus. And what this is doing is leading to inflammation, scarring, and painful cysts. It can also lead to a buildup of fibrous tissue between the reproductive organs that can cause them to stick together. However, today, we're going to be looking at how it's diagnosed with artificial intelligence. My guest today is Soma Babarak, the founder and CEO of Hera Biotech. Now, they have created the first non-surgical diagnostic tool for endometriosis that will help women all around the world get diagnosed without surgery and far more effectively. So happy to have you on, Soma. It's such a big issue. Can we start with you telling me a little bit about your background and how you got into this and what led you to found Hera Biotech?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for asking. So my background educationally, my undergrad is in entrepreneurship from the University of Texas, and my master's is in data analytics from Louisiana State University. I left my undergrad and went to work for a venture capital fund. I had invented a device in women's health, and during my undergrad, that led me to a venture capital fund. They picked me up. I worked for them for 10 years. It was a life science venture capital fund. I worked in two of the companies as a director of clinical operations. Those companies were exited, and I really wanted to get back into women's health. And so I found this technology at the University of Texas Health Science Center, and I was really, really excited by the amount of bench work that had gone into validating the why behind this technology, but also the way that they were using single cell technology, which creates huge amounts of data. So they were using also cell clustering algorithms paired with machine learning paradigms. And that to me was just so very exciting because I think it gives us really the best shot when you're talking about something that's this complex.
Yeah. And let's look at the patient. You know, what can you tell me what women with endometriosis experience?
Yes, actually, I'm acutely aware of that. it's a very personal issue to me and my family. So every patient is different, and it's important to start there. But really, one of the hallmark symptoms of endometriosis is heavy menstrual cycles and extremely painful menstrual cycles. And very, very often you will also have bowel disruption. So that can either mean being constipated or having diarrhea. It's really important to think about those things because all of those things are subjective measures. And so when a patient presents, you know, oftentimes they're complaining about pain with the menstrual cycle. Well, that's somewhat been normalized in our society. And so people think, well, yeah, of course you're in pain. It's your menstrual cycle. It's not supposed to be, you know, but that trivializes a symptom that's actually abnormal. And so it's very, very, very difficult to diagnose. And it is a huge cost on the quality of life of the patient because then it spirals into a mental health issue. Is it me? Am I weird? Why doesn't anybody believe me? You know, and it can just really go on from there.
Yes, because the pain is debilitating, isn't it? It can be very, very bad. And yet it's minimized by doctors that don't realize who say, well, actually, it's menstrual pain. You're fine. That's normal. So, yeah, I can imagine. Right. Yeah. So what do you think the biggest issue is with endometriosis?
So twofold, right? And it's really a chicken or the egg question. Yeah. There is no treatment for endometriosis other than surgical procedures. And there's two types of surgical procedures. There's an ablation surgery where they go in and attempt to find the lesions and then ablate or burn them. Yeah. I would not recommend that. And then there's really what they consider the gold standard, which is an excision surgery where the physician goes in and actually excises the lesions from the peritoneal cavity. Unfortunately, those surgeons who do the excision surgery are highly specialized, and meaning there are very few of them. And in places like the US, where you're dealing with, you know, payer systems, ablation surgery is reimbursed the same way that excision surgery is reimbursed. So a lot of these excision surgeons don't accept insurance because it's a much more complex and timely surgery. So that's one big issue with it. And then the other side of the spectrum is we have very, very poor ways of diagnosing this disease. So it's kind of one of two things. Either you get a diagnostic laparoscopy, which they often do a diagnose and treat. It will most likely be an ablation surgery if you're doing it that way. And that's where the surgeon tries to go in and find the lesions, excise them, and send them for pathology to confirm that that is, in fact, endometrial tissue growing where it shouldn't be, or tissue similar to the endometrium. And so the problem with this is endometrial lesions are very different and varied in the way that they appear. So they can be blue, chocolate brown, red, white. And so they often get mistaken for benign cyst or scar tissue or, you know, and so the success even of the laparoscopic surgery for diagnosis is limited. And the other way is people just empirically diagnose. Oh, well, it kind of sounds like you might have endometriosis. So let's just say that you have endometriosis, but with no treatment, what does that really mean for the patient? So they kind of feed each other, the two big problems in endometriosis.
Yeah. So, I mean, diagnosis is a massive problem. I'm curious actually how you solve that without surgery.
Absolutely. So The two co-inventors of our technology come from very different backgrounds. So you have Dr. Bruce Nicholson, who is in structural and cellular biology. So what that means is that he has studied for over 40 years now, how do cells communicate? What mediates cell behavior? And specifically, he is a world-renowned expert on gap junction genes and specifically their structural proteins, connexins. He discovered the first connexin, sequenced the second one, and he's been studying them for over 40 years. What they're best known to do is mediate invasive cell behavior. Okay. Then you have Dr. Namir Kirma, who comes from a female health background, specifically in female reproductive oncology and single cell genetics, genomics, epigenetics, assay development. They came together and decided to take a very oncology-based approach to endometriosis. So connexins are very well studied in oncology because that's the invasive thing that you see in oncology, right? Where they fall down in oncology is that they don't have anything to do with unregulated growth of tissue. Well, that's really when endometriosis stops being cancer, is that it just doesn't grow at an unregulated rate. Yeah. So what we do, the way that we approach this, is we look at the tissue that we believe is causing the problem, which is the endometrium. And we take a sample of that through a Pipel biopsy. We're also looking at ways to extract cells from menstrual effluent, which is proving very exciting, so hopefully even reducing the burden further. And what we do is we take that tissue and we separate it into the two main cell types, so stromal and epithelial cells. And what we've discovered is that those two cell types have an almost perfectly negatively correlated expression in these gap junction genes. So it goes up in epithelial cells, it goes down in stromal cells. If somebody just looked at that tissue as a whole, those two would cancel each other out and it would look like nothing's happening, which is a lot of how tissue studies start. it isn't until you look at it on a single cell level that you see this marked misregulation. And that is what led us to this discovery. These cells are primed for invasive behavior before they ever leave the uterus. And so my first question when I met with the inventors was, how do they get out? How do they get out of the uterus?
Yeah. Just like going holiday.
That's a relatively closed system as far as I'm aware. But what I was shocked to learn is that about 90 to maybe even higher percentage of women go through something called retrograde menstruation. And it's where a portion of your menstrual effluent, the tissue, is refluxed back into the peritoneal cavity. And so that's been a very highly controversial theory on how endometriosis starts. And it's called Samson's theory, that this tissue is, you know, put out there that way, and that's why it happens. The only difference is, in Samson's theory, you couldn't explain why do some women get endo and others don't, when 90% of women or greater go through this. Well, understanding that this, some women have this misregulation in those cells, that answers that question. So women who have this genetic predisposition, so to speak, when those cells are refluxed out into the peritoneal cavity, they are ready to invade. They're primed for invasive behavior. And so we've actually shown that on the bench. So we create basically a peritoneal cavity in a dish. And when you introduce these endometrial cells with this misregulation, when they find mesothelial tissue, which happens to be the majority of the tissue type in your peritoneal cavity, they cause huge induction. They actually cause that tissue to move apart, and it allows those cells to drop in and begin to proliferate and create that lesion. So that's what we're doing. We're looking at the cells that are responsible for going out and starting that lesion formation. So we take them from the uterus now. Hopefully, eventually, we'll be able to move into, you know, just collecting your menstrual effluent. And we run our analysis, and we can tell you whether or not you've got endometriosis based on your genetic expression in those cell types.
Wow, that's so cool. And how are you using AI in your process?
Yes. So this is very, very exciting. As a data analyst, like, this just makes my heart go pitter patter, because data science, I think, is the coolest kind of science.
Of course.
So what we do, so when we collect single cells, right? So the easiest way to think about this is, if you were going to have a blood test, and we're going to take a count of some gene expression in your blood. So like they do, you know, with the circulating tumor DNA or things like that. If we have 5 genes that we're looking for, we take your blood and we're doing an average of all of that expression in those 5 genes. So we get 5 data points per that person that we took that blood draw on.
Yeah.
With single cell analysis, we use chips, microfluidic chips, to sort the cells and then prime them and then extract the readouts for the DNA and the RNA. So every single cell, we take about 48 for each cell type. And then we're looking at about 45 genes in each one of those cells. And we're looking at 2 cell types in a single patient. That produces about 4,600 data points per patient. So you can imagine, this is massive amounts of data. So we use AI in sorting all of that data to look for that genetic expression in each individual cell and clustering those cells together that have the high expression. And so that's how we determine whether or not you have endometriosis. Is it's a certain threshold of the percentage of cells expressing high or low in these different genes that we're looking at in 2 different cell types. So I like to think of it as a massive Rubik's cube of information, and AI comes in and is, you know, one of these Rubik's cubes masters and juggles it up, and then 3 seconds has it, boom, there it is. And here's all your sides with all your gene expression. And it's amazing. Yeah, how it works.
That's very cool. And so once the tissue is taken by the doctor, does it then get sent to a lab, and the labs actually have your test in the lab?
Yeah, so the easiest way to think about this, if anybody's familiar with women's health, sorry, that's my reference point. It's very similar to having your annual pap smear done. Okay. We're collecting cells, we're just collecting them from the uterus instead of at the cervix. That tissue then gets sent to a lab. The lab runs the analysis and within about 5 to 7 business days turns around an answer.
Yeah. And so how many labs, is it all in the US? Are you global or is it more US based at the moment?
So it's more US based at the moment. We're doing clinical trials now. We've done one pilot study. We're now in our second proof of concept study. That said, we have filed our patent in 10 territories worldwide. So coming soon to a lab near you. We have actually we're working through a deal now with a partner who wants to commercialize it in China. We're exploring some potential opportunities in Europe as well. So soon, hopefully, we'll be available there. We're going to commercialize first in the US as what's called a laboratory developed test while we pursue FDA approval. And most territories globally have this sort of mechanism where, you know, the governments recognize labs can develop very useful tests that aren't introducing any new technique into the patient that may cause, you know, a safety concern. And so they allow them to operate out of a single central lab while they go through their governmental approval. And that's exactly what we'll be capitalizing on.
And so if a woman wanted to have that test, how can she know whether her doctor, the lab that they use, has it, or can she influence that at any point?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things I love about this particular patient population is they are so educated about their own condition because, quite frankly, the research community and the medical community hasn't had very many answers for them. So they've gone on their own and well-researched their condition. So absolutely, she can advocate by calling her physician and saying, hey, I'm having these symptoms. I think that these may be consistent with endometriosis. I'd like to be tested for endometriosis. Do you offer the Mitri DX test?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's certainly, you know, hopefully they will. but if not, we'll be updating our website as well once it's available where you can get this test.
Oh, that would be really helpful. So they could then go to your website and say, this is my location. What's the nearest doctor that could do that has a test access. Okay. And so I really like the concept of actually finding the cells in the menstrual effluent. I mean, that's pretty cool because then you could do a DTC version where almost like a tampon or something like that, and it could then be sent in to the lab and tested, I assume.
Yes, absolutely. That's the goal. So the way to think about it is we've started just with most good diagnostics, right? You start with the purest form of the sample and the purest form of the test. And then you start to work your way down and figure out how can I collect this at the least amount of burden and not compromise very much on the quality side. And so that's what we're looking at. And so we've developed a 5-gene model, our AI model, that we use in both cell types when we collect both cell types from the uterine lining. We've also constructed 2-gene models in each of the individual cell types. So the trouble with menstrual effluent is it's very unlikely that you would be able to get both cell types in sufficient numbers to run our analysis. But if we could just get one cell type, it would give us a very good screening diagnostic, which would then allow you to come into the physician and it would make sense. And in my world, it needs to happen. I would love for this test to happen when a young woman has her first menstrual cycle. What I don't want is to be doing an endometrial biopsy on a child, essentially, who most likely has not been sexually active. And it's a bit more invasive than a pap smear. I would akin to having an IUD placed. So if we could simply collect her menstrual effluent, this is a non-invasive, non-traumatic way to screen her because it really should change the way that she moves through the healthcare system.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as young as 15 year olds have it as well, don't they? So that would be so much less invasive for someone of that age, for sure.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. And what about, there are pharmaceuticals in this space as well, usually given after surgery, I guess. Do you work with any pharmaceutical companies in this space?
Have they expressed interest? Yes. So we've received a lot of interest from pharmaceuticals in this space. So this kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning, that kind of chicken or the egg argument. Yeah. So in the US, there are no drugs. And actually, I don't know anywhere in the world, there are no drugs approved to treat endometriosis.
No.
What yeah. you have are drugs that are approved to treat the pain associated with endometriosis. And many of these drugs do this by simply inducing menopause. Endometriosis is an estrogen-hungry disease. So by chemically inducing menopause, we eliminate the estrogen and the menstrual cycle, and so oftentimes some of the symptoms. Yet there is a whole host of things that we have now opened up in terms of problems and side effects. And it's not helpful for someone who wants to have a baby. And so one of the things that we've been really excited about is the warm reception that we have received from pharmaceutical companies. Yeah. They have drug candidates, for example, that have had very good efficacy in mouse models or monkey models or any of the models that they use to look at efficacy. The problem is when they move into human clinical trials, there is no way to prove that their drug is actually having an effect on modifying the disease itself unless they were willing to cut a patient open multiple times over the course of the clinical trial to ensure that their drug was working. But no one's going to let them do that. That's horribly invasive and dangerous for the patient.
Yeah.
So with a product like ours on the market, it's giving them a quantitative genetic readout of what's happening. They would be able to track efficacy over the course of the clinical trial and know whether or not they're having a modifying effect on the disease. So the nice thing about our particular gene set is they're not particularly influenced by hormones. So hormonal treatments really aren't the answer. Hormonal treatments are the answer to symptom control. They're not the answer to controlling the disease itself. So I think this opens up the door to some really meaningful innovation in the therapeutic space.
Yeah, no, that's would be huge, because I think that would be a huge hamper before, if you have to have surgery just to check if your drug's working. Whereas now, if you can actually have this kind of thing that is, you know, not fully invasive, it's a little bit invasive,
right.
But it's certainly not surgery. To just check the efficacy of the drug and how it's going through the clinical trials, that's massive. I mean, incredible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Hopefully it changes the entire, paradigm, because I think for a long time, speaking on behalf of several patients close to me, people just relegated it to, it's a pelvic disease, it's a woman's disease, it's a period disease. So all of those things kind of, put it over in the bucket of just give her birth control, just give her some hormones and she'll be fine. It'll all be fine. No, that's just not the answer to everything. It's hormones affect the tissue, but that's not the end of the disease. It's not a hormonal disease. It's a tissue-based disease. So we have invasion, we have proliferation. So it's very, very much like cancer. We wouldn't tell people just give her some hormones and her cancer will go away. No, that's not how that works.
there's no one actually knows, though, do they, why some women have that predisposition for those wandering cells, as I'll call them.
Right.
Than others. It's still quite a mystery, isn't it?
It is quite a mystery. But I mean, if you think about it in terms of those things, there's very few things that we understand why the gene goes awry in whatever particular condition we're talking about. That's but true. The promising thing is, once we understand the gene that has gone awry, then we are able to actually learn so much more about the disease from a focused point versus just an infinite number of reasons why you may or may not be having this. And I think that that's what shows the most promise. We always, again, going back to that pap smear, pap smears came along and opened such a window into why cervical cancer and what are the early signs of cervical cancer. You know, it's the same progression. We knew cervical cancer was bad. We knew it was killing people. Not that endometriosis in and of itself kills people, but it's a significant strain on quality of life. And there are mental health concerns, and it does seem to be linked to ovarian cancer. It's certainly linked to severe maternal mortality. I mean, women with endo are, I think it's 1.5 times more likely to die from hemorrhaging post-mortem or postpartum, excuse me. Thank you. and so it's a huge problem, but then comes the pap smear, and we figure out that it's very small changes on the cells of the cervix indicate that these cells are becoming invasive, and that will then cause cervical cancer. And then we figured out that the HPV virus causes these cellular changes on the surface of this cervix. Now we have a vaccine. So you can see that it all starts with having a diagnostic that's reliable, that you can track and follow and learn from.
Yeah. No, it's very impressive, work. So if there's any pharma listening that are looking at compounds in clinical trials for endometriosis, you can get in touch with Soma and her team at herabiotech.com. And I totally agree that this changes the whole landscape of clinical trials for this space. It's really impressive. So thank you so much. I mean, incredible, very, very interesting. And also if there's any women listening that have those symptoms, there will be a way if you reach out to Soma to find out which doctors actually have that test and have the access to the labs that actually can do that. So look forward to hearing when you come out of the US and have other countries. I know you're on your way, but that would be really interesting to hear that as well.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to helping women globally. It's really important.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I truly appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.